Right, let's start with this evening's shiur on Parshas Behar.
We're leaving that just in case. And Parshas Behar has a symphonic structure to it, but that symphonic structure itself gives rise to a crucial question of the opening to the parsha. And it would actually be good if you've got chumashim when you can. You might just find it a lot easier if I can refer you through it as we move through it. It's the beginning of the parasha that really becomes quite crucial in understanding its centrality and its importance. I do want to make sure that this is coming out. The parasha starts with Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe b'Har Sinai le'emor. Hashem spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai saying, this is the only time other than at Har Sinai proper that we're told that this was given at Har Sinai, although chronologically this part of it in the Torah is much later. So the reason given is Moshe gives this piece of Torah to the Jewish people before he expects them to be going into Israel. They're about to go into the land of Israel. It turns out that they're somewhat delayed, but at this point he doesn't know that. And he thinks that he's preparing them for coming into Eretz Israel. And so he gives them the laws of Shemitah, which were already given at Har Sinai, and they're referred to earlier in chapter 23, in Shemot chapter 23. But here he gives them in detail. He teaches these halachas, the laws of leaving the land fallow every 7 years. He teaches these laws in detail here, whereas earlier on in Shemot they're mentioned just in general. Why is that so? So why are we told earlier and we're told again here that God gave him this at Har Sinai? So have a look at the first Rashi. Those of you who can follow Rashi, follow it inside, and those of you who don't, follow it outside. Where Rashi says, "My inyan shmita etzel Har Sinai." Why is shmita chosen of all the laws to be attached to Har Sinai? All the laws were given at Har Sinai. Why is shmita? Why is the law of leaving the land fallow every 7 years chosen as the one that is attached to Har Sinai in this particular opening of the parasha? So that makes it a very, very central and important piece of learning. At the end of the day, everything was taught on Sinai, not just Shemitah. Why is this one particularly referred to as something God gave to Moshe on Har Sinai? And Rashi says, Elo ma Shemitah nemru klaloseho v'dikdukeho misinai. What it comes to teach is just that every detail of Shemitah, all the details which Moshe is about to teach the people, came from Sinai. God gave those laws at Sinai and Moshe learned them there. Afkulam, so all the mitzvahs, all the laws, even though they might so far only have been expressed in a fairly brief, general form, Nemru klaosehen v'diktukehen misinai. Their details, every detail of the law, every principle, every aspect of the law, was all given by God on Mount Sinai. These weren't things that developed later on. They weren't things that Moshe made up on his own. These were all things that that Hashem gave to Moshe on Har Sinai, and Moshe taught them at the appropriate places as they were going through the desert. What's important, the piece that I really wanted to notice here, is not just the fact of what Rashi's just commented based on the Torah's Kohanim, but the fact that of all things, Shemitah is chosen as the one to teach us that principle. Because now we're learning two things from this piece of Chumash. We're learning the laws of Shemitah, we're learning the agricultural laws of letting the land lie fallow every 7 years. That's one thing we're learning. We're learning something else altogether. We're learning a hashkafic idea. We're learning the idea that all the laws of the Torah, all the halachos of the Torah, every detail was given on Sinai to Moshe and was handed down there. So which law is chosen as the vehicle to teach us that principle, which is a worldview principle, that's a principle of the whole Torah. Which law is chosen? Shemitah. I might have thought the law of serving idolatry would have been chosen as the thing. I might have thought the law of murder might have been chosen as the example. Why is Shemitah an agricultural law that applies only in Israel and only at certain times, according to some, chosen as the the law to teach us the principle that every aspect of the Torah comes from Sinai. Clearly that means that Shemitah is a central principle. Shemitah is not just an agricultural law that applies to farmers of the land working in Israel. It is that as well, but it must be something much more than that. It must be much more central to everything we believe and everything that we are. And what I want to do this evening with you is actually understand what that centrality is. What is so important? What are the principles that we learn from this that make it so terribly important? And the reason that I suggest it is so central is because Shemitah defines the essence of a human being's value system. It gets to the heart. It is the projection of everything we believe about life. Shemitah. This law that you've got to leave the land fallow every 7 years, this defines us more than any other law. Because this law defines the way we view the relationship between time and money. And that is core to the way we live. What differentiates one person from another, not just one nation from another, what differentiates one person from another is their view of time and their view of money, and most important of all, their view of the relationship between time and money. And that's what we learn from Shemitah. Let's try and understand it a little further. What is Shemitah? So one of the phrases used with Shemitah, I'm not going into the details of the laws of Shemitah. Nowadays you can look that up on the internet. You don't need a shiur to learn the laws of Shemitah. But to understand the insights of Shemitah, that's different. What are the insights? Well, the important word, the important phrase is at the end of verse 2, where it says, V'shavso ha'oret shabbos la'Hashem. The land will have a Shabbos. The land will be left to rest. And then the Torah adds two important words, Shabbos la'Hashem. And if you look at the trop underneath that, you'll see how that la'Hashem is emphasized. The way the Torah emphasizes is by punctuation. It doesn't underline and it doesn't put in bold and it doesn't put in italics. The way it emphasizes is by the way you read it. And that's why we're so particular about the way the Torah is read by the Baal Koreh on Shabbos. When the Baal Koreh gets up to read, it's not only that he must pronounce the words correctly, he must phrase it correctly, and he must use the correct intonations, because the intonations explain the intention. So if you look at under the word Shabbos, you've got a tipcho, which is that closed kind of bracket, and we've commented before, that's like a semicolon. Which isn't what one would expect there. One would expect it to be v'shavta ha'aretz, and the land will have a rest, will be left to rest. Shabbos la'Hashem, a Shabbos for Hashem. But you see the emphasis, v'shavta ha'aretz, and the land will be rested. Shabbos, this is a Shabbos. Pause. Hashem, this is for God. This is not for the land. This is not for you. This is for God. So now all of a sudden, Shemitah moves out of the realm of agriculture into the realm of the highest areas of Avodas Hashem, of service of God. We're using the land as a vehicle for service of God in Shemitah, which we see from the trop in those words, Shabbos. If it would just have stopped there, it would have said Shabbos la'Hashem, it's kind of a divine Sabbath. We would have said very nice, that's a nice cultural thing that the Jews should celebrate. But that's not what it's saying at all. Shabbos, this is a time of rest. Pause. La'Hashem. This is for God. What does that mean? So three different opinions as to what it means. Rashi, the Ibn Ezra, and the Sforno. Let's look at Rashi on Pasuk Beis. Shabbos la'Hashem. L'shem Hashem. You've got to do this for God. This is not for the land. This is not so that the land recovers its strength. This is not because it's good for agriculture. This is not for the economy. This is for God. You do this for Hashem. This is L'shem Hashem. The Sforno you don't have in front of you says the following. Shetihye kol hashono habetelo me'avodas ha'adoma. What this means is that you should dedicate the entire year during which you are free from working the land. Muchenes la'avodosu. It is available to serve God with. So this is to give you time to serve God. so that the farmers and the people who work the land are able to take this year off every 7 years, and for an entire year they can go to yeshiva, they can study, they can learn, they can invest in themselves and in their families. They don't have to be getting up at the crack of dawn to take care of the crops and work till late at night. They don't have to worry about the irrigation and the rain and the fertilizing. They don't have to have any of those worries. For a year, there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing they can do. It's like Shabbos, like every day when Shabbos comes around once a week. Part of the beauty of Shabbos, there's nothing to worry about because there's nothing you can do. The fact that you cannot do anything about the things we normally worry is what makes Shabbos restful. All the things we worry about, you can do nothing about on Shabbos. What are you worried about? Your business? There's nothing you can do about it. A whole lot of things you're supposed to do? Nothing you can do about it. How many emails you've got? Nothing you can do about it. Your health? Can't even do anything about that. Can't take medication. You understand then why you can't take medication. It's not just because of medication. All, just don't do anything about the things you're worried about. Then you'll stop worrying. You only worry when there's something you can do about it. But if there's nothing you can do about it, what can you do? Well, feel sorry for the physicians among us because the things that you worry, but you're worried about other people's well-being. But in terms of the things we worry about for ourselves, nothing you can do on Shabbos. So we rest. That's why Shabbos is restful. And Shemitah is the same. All the things a farmer worries about during the Shemitah year, he can't do anything about. If he can't do anything about it, he can turn off, he can relax for the entire year. And dedicate that year, muchenes la'avoy dosoy, ready and able to be dedicated to the service of God. So you become a servant of God, you become a priest, you become a kohen, you become dedicated to the service of God for that entire year. That's what the Shemitah is according to the Sforno. And the Ibn Ezra says something a little bit different. On Pasuk Dalad, where it says, also, and on the seventh year, Shabbos Shabbaton Yehiyeh La'oretz Shabbos, and look at the, if you look on verse 4 again, you've got that same punctuation. And on the seventh year, it will be a Shabbos of Shabboses. So seventh, not just a seventh day after 7 days, but a seventh year after 7 years, after 6 years. Yehiyeh La'oretz, Shabbos, pause, Hashem. Once again, this is for God. Says the Ibn Ezra, he actually says it further on, and he says, Hatam, the reason is, Kishnas Shabbaton hi la'oretz, v'hatam sh'ha'oretz eino birshuscho b'ashano azos. That year, the land does not belong to you. It's Shabbos la'Hashem, meaning not that the Shabbos is la'Hashem, the land belongs to God. So then he would read this pause a little differently. And on the seventh year, Shabbos, Shabboson, Yeh La'oretz, the land will be rested for that year. Shabbos, a rest. La'Hashem, because the land belongs to Hashem. During that year, the land is not yours. So the three slightly different angles of interpretation. Rashi says, do this for the sake of God. The Sforno says, take the time that you're given in the Shemitah year and dedicate that time to God. And the Ibn Ezra says the field belongs to God during that year. It's not your field, so you're not allowed to work in it. It doesn't belong to you. In any event, that makes it all of those things make it very serious. And we've got to ask ourselves, why wouldn't we do it? Why might one not keep the Shemitah year? The Shemitah year was not an easy thing to keep. And particularly in years where the economy and the agricultural climate wasn't that wonderful, it's not an easy thing to keep Shemitah for a year. Imagine the field to be your business or your profession. It's all very well. You think about a farmer. You're not a farmer. You don't know what it's like. But imagine the mitzvah was for a year, shut down your business, close your profession. Close up. Don't put somebody else in your place. Close the doors. And not only that, but your stock should be open. If anybody wants to come and help themselves to what you have to your stock, they can come and do that. It's okay. It doesn't belong to you this year. Your business doesn't belong to you that year. It's open. You can also go. You can also help yourself to what you've got. You can consume what's there, but you can't produce, and nor can you protect. It's available for anybody. Imagine how difficult that would be for us to do. But that's what it was for them. Their fields were their businesses. So it was a very difficult law to keep. And one has to say to oneself, why is it such a difficult law to keep? If God said, close your business for a year and invest in yourselves and in your families, and I'll take care of your business, why wouldn't we do it? What holds us back? So So there's clearly two things that could be holding us back. We could be held back by insecurity, by the fear that we'll come back after a year and there won't be enough to eat, and it takes a while to get the business going. So it's not just the seventh year, it's the eighth year as well before we get going. And who knows whether we're going, whether the business will survive. Who knows whether I'll be able to get the farm going again. What will we eat in the interim? So we get gripped by fear, and the fear deprives us of that year. That's the one thing that can happen. And the second thing that can happen is that it's a statement of values, that we believe time is money. So if you just think about that and you say, so what is God asking me to do? He's asking me to take a year off. A year is worth a lot of money. And my expenses carry on. Nothing stops. My expenses don't cost. Where's the money going to come from? And not even if I have the money, would I really give away a year of revenue every 7 years? Give away an entire year of revenue, of income, and just give up on it? That's very hard for us to do when we're raised in an environment where we consider time to be money. But the truth is, because we think time is money, we're not willing to trade money for time. We're willing to trade time for money. We're willing to invest time, all of our time, to get money. If I said to you, work a little harder, another hour a day, and you said, and what will I get out of it? And I said, an increase of 25% on your earnings this year. That's a good deal. We're willing to do that. Who wouldn't? But if we do it the other way around, we won't do it. If I say to you, trade an hour for 25% of your earnings, you'd say, how can I do that? It's not possible. Can't do it. So we don't believe time is money and money is time. It's not an equation. When we say time is money, we believe not that time and money are equal. We believe money is what's important and time is what you need in order to earn money. So we're making a declaration of values when we say time is money. We've got to be very honest with ourselves. What we're saying is we believe money is more valuable than time. And we're willing to trade time for money, but we're not willing to trade money for time. That's the value. And that's the value we teach our kids. Whether we articulate it or not, that's the way we live. And if you think about how rational that is, and you ask yourself, which is more valuable? So value is determined by two factors. What are the two factors that determine value?
Scarcity.
Scarcity, supply, and demand. Simple economics 101, supply and demand. What is there more supply of to each individual? Money or time? There's more supply of time. There's less supply of time. Time, you know you're going to run out. And there's no more when that runs out. It's finished. And you don't even know how much you've got. But whatever it is, it's an absolute limited bucket. When that's emptied, there's nothing more there. Money, you work, you make, you produce. You can develop, you can invest, you can grow your assets. Can't grow your time. You can't increase your time. You can't invest in your time. So from a scarcity perspective, money is much more scarce than time. So time is much more scarce than money. What about from the demand perspective? Do people demand more money or more time? What is more in demand?
Money.
Time, because with time I can make money. So what people want is more time. What people are desperate for is time at the moment, particularly now, more than they're desperate for money. We're living in a time, certainly in the developed world, where people aren't that desperate for money, most people. And even in the undeveloped world, they're not that desperate for money because they don't have that value of money being more important than anything. So, in terms of demand, if you were to say to somebody, what would you want? To live another 10 years or have another $1 million? What are they going to say? Who's going to choose the $1 million and say, okay, take my life, give me the million? We're not going to say that. Time is worth more to us than money. Time is life. So if time is scarcer and in greater demand than money, it must be more valuable than money. So what should we trade for what? We should trade money for time. And the truth is, in some ways, that's what a lot of today's economy is. I was trying to work out how much of today's economy is about time, about giving people time, efficiency, and leisure, and what to do with their spare time. If you take all the entertainment industry, and you take all the tourism industry and travel industry, and you take all of the efficiency industry, that's most of technology, and you say all of that is about giving people more time. How much of the economy is about creating time, which gives you an idea how much that people want that. And then what to do with the time is we're not using our time. It's not as if we're valuing our time. But we see that there's a need for time, there's a demand for time, and there's a scarcity of time. There's a terrible scarcity of time today. And yet we're willing to trade money for time, but not time for money. We're willing to trade time for money, but not money for time. Do you see what the Shemitah year is? The Shemitah is an opportunity to test ourselves, our character. It's an opportunity to show our children. We're willing to trade money for time. Yes, we are losing 1/7 of our revenue. And God says He'll make it up for us. We hope He will. Will we ever know? We'll never know. If we do well, we'll think we could have done even better. If we don't do well, we'll think we could have done well had we worked. We'll never know. So the fact is, I've got to be ready to accept I'm working 6 out of 7 years. Just as I accept that I'm working 6 out of 7 days, I can accept that I'm working 6 out of 7 years. And the other year, I'm taking the revenue of that year and I'm investing it in my Avodas Hashem. So if I make $100,000 a year or $1 million a year, I'm taking that $100,000 or that $1 million and I'm investing it in time. I'm buying back a year. That's what I'm doing. And if you think of it in a sense, what differentiates a slave from a free man? What is the difference between a slave and a... What is an eved?
His time is not his own.
An eved is somebody who sells his time forward. That's all he does. We all work for a boss. Even if we're in our own businesses, we're working for our customers and we're working for our investors and we're working for our creditors. We're all working for bosses. So what makes us an eved or not? If you sell your time forward, like the basketball players do and the baseball, they are avodim. They contract their time. They sell their time forward. That's slavery. It doesn't say in the Torah anywhere you're not a slave if you sell yourself for millions. There's no quantum. You're a slave if you sell yourself. If you sell your time, you're a slave because you're saying money is, I'm willing to trade time for money. I'm willing for my time not to be my own as long as I get enough money for it. Shemitah is the opportunity to demonstrate freedom. Because if I'm willing to say I'm willing to trade money for time, I will give you back the money, give me back some time. That's a free person. That's somebody who hasn't sold their time forward. So Shemitah becomes very important and very central. So if we go further, now let's look at the structure of the parasha. So if we go further, and have a look at it with me. So we've got the whole year of Shemitah, and that's followed by the year of Yovel, the law of Yovel. So now you've got every 7 years is Shemitah. Every seven Shemitahs, after every seven Shemitah, that's the 50th year, is a Yovel. And the Yovel property goes back to the original owners. Now that changes the whole economy of trading property. Because land can only be bought on a maximum of a 49-year lease. Which means when you buy land in Eretz Israel, you're not buying the capital. You're not actually buying the land at all. All you're buying and selling, all you can trade is the output of the land. You're a trading product. The land goes back after 49 years, the land goes back to the original owner. So again, this is not just an agricultural law. This enables us to become less attached to the property we buy because all we're buying is output. Once that's the case, that we're only buying output, then we've got to be very careful in verse 14, a little further on, v'chitim kurum em kala misecho, ekonomi ala misecho, when you sell or you buy, al tonu ish es achiv. Don't oppress, don't manipulate your brother. B'mispar shonim achara yovel tiknei meis ha misecho, b'mispar shnei tvoes yim cholach. You buy according to the number of seasons that still remain before the leasehold is over and the property returns to the original owner. So if you're selling a property right after the Yovel, they've got 49 years of produce. And if each year, and you've got to figure out what that is in net present value. So you say, I've got 49 years ahead. I'm going to get X amount each year, but I've got to invest some money up front. I've got to buy the property. I've got to buy the lease for the 49 years. And then I've got to invest every year in taking care of the property. And each year I can expect X amount for revenue. So the profit per year is such and such, and I can calculate my return on investment and how much I pay. That's how you calculate property, the price of property. The same as kind of when you buy property, even now, and people make calculations. What in the industry is a fair rate of return? And if I've got selling you an apartment block, you'll figure out what the apartment block can generate annually and how that relates to the amount of returns that you need on the capital. And if the norm in the industry is that in 10 years you expect to get your capital back, then you'll want to see that you're somewhere in that range. So it is with a field. You're selling the product, you're not selling the object, you're not selling the field. And the warning here is, make sure that in the negotiations that's very transparent. And it's quite strange, and if it's not, it's called manipulation. And it's manipulation even if the outcome isn't that the person pays more. And what's really interesting is that the Gemara says, and we paskin, that there's ein eino bekarkos. You can't overpay for property. Because property, sooner or later, will be worth what you paid for it. If you hold on long enough. With metaltalin, with movable property, that isn't so. You could overpay for an asset, and the asset might never, ever be worth what you paid for it. That's called eino. So the halacha restricts and says you're not permitted to charge more than a sixth over the market price. So if the market price is currently 100, you can charge 115, or whatever the exact amount is, if both parties agree. But if you charge more than that, so if I pay you 150, and later on I discover that the market price was 100, the sale can be invalidated. I can go back, give you your money back, give you your item back, you give me the money back, and the sale is invalidated. Because we're not permitted to charge one another more than a sixth above market price. Not so with property. With property, whatever the two people agree is valid, and the sale cannot be invalidated. However, the Torah warns, you've committed a sin against God. If you've overcharged for property in terms of what it can realistically yield over the remaining life of the lease, then you've overcharged. And even if the other person was aware of it, that's still called manipulation, and you've taken advantage of somebody, and that's loitoni, you're not allowed to do that. So you've got to be willing to leave money on the table. So you've got a prime property now. That's worth $10 million. But it's such an unusual property, and there's so many people who are willing to buy it, that you go to auction kind of, and although the market price is $10 million, you find a buyer who's willing to pay $15 million. You've got an opportunity to make an extra 50%, $5 million. What does the Torah want you to do? Say, no, thank you. I don't want the extra $5 million. That would be an Isser of Eino. I'm not allowed to do that. I'm not willing to trade my soul for money. To take advantage of you, I lose my soul. What do I get in place of it? Money. I don't sell soul for money. I'm a Jew. I sell money for soul. I buy soul with money. I give money to tzedakah. I buy a beautiful esrog. I buy a pair of tefillin. I invest money in soul. I don't invest soul in money. And so the $5 million can stay on the table. It's unnatural. Just as Shemitah is unnatural. It's unnatural to leave your business for a year and go to yeshiva and study. It's unnatural to leave millions of dollars on the table if the buyer is willing to pay. You've got to say, I'm sorry, I can't take that money from you. And he says, I'm very happy to pay you. You've got to say, but I'm not happy to take that money. So either you take it at my price, or I find another buyer. That's how a Jew deals. It's unnatural. And look what goes on further. Not only do you have to be careful about Eino with property and with metaltalin, with movable property, but you've also got to be careful with Einas Devorim, which is just not to give people, says Rashi, that's giving people advice which suits you but doesn't suit them. Somebody comes to you for an opinion, for an advice, and you manipulate them. You use your knowledge to advise them against their own interests. That's Eino. Is that unnatural? So I'm in a position of power, I have information. You don't. You come to me for information, and I have an opportunity to gain so much by advising you in a way that's not in your best interest. It's natural that I should want to make the profit out of you. The unnatural thing is, I've got to tell you what's good for you, not what's good for me. That's a nice dvorim. And if you do all that, then we're told in verse 18, just look how the symphony is building up. And if you do all this properly, you will dwell in the land with a sense of security. Do you want to know what security is? Security doesn't come from the fences you build, and security doesn't come from the armies you build. At the end of the day, security is within yourself. Security is a feeling. Security is not a thing outside of yourself. Security is a value. And you feel secure when you live this way. Says Rashi, Vishavtem laveta chaleo, you'll dwell in security. In the next verse, in 19, Venos Nohoritz Pirio, the land will give its fruit. Vachaltem lasoive, you'll eat with satisfaction. Vishavtem lovetach, and you'll live in security. Ole, again, look at the punctuation. It's so beautiful. The musical notes are so beautiful. It's part of the symphony. Vishavtem lovetach, you will live in security wherever you are. But in this case, Aleha, on that very land that you let lie fallow for every seventh year, on that land in Israel, you will live with a sense of security. And what does that mean, says Rashi? Shelo tidaku mishnas patzuris, you won't worry about the economy. Why won't you worry about the economy? Because God promises the economy will be good? No, that's not the reason. The reason is because the economy is not the most important thing in your life. You're worried about your soul. You're worried about your neshama. You're worried about your spiritual growth. You're willing to trade economy for spiritual growth. So if the economy is good or bad, not the end of the world, so you relax. You let go. You won't worry about the economy. Leave that to God. We like to believe we control the economy. Says God, the only thing you control is yourself. If you can live in a secure fashion, how does a secure person live? A secure person says, I don't want to take so much money for this property because it's not worth that. A secure person says, I don't want to give you advice that isn't good for you, even if it's good for me. It's not worth it for me. I don't want to do that. That's what a secure person does. So if you live in a secure way, if you live securely, you will feel security. V'achaltem la'tzova, what does that mean? Af betoich ha'mein ayin tehei bo bracha. You know, we think that having plenty means having plenty in the bank. Having plenty really means having plenty in your stomach. It means that you don't feel you're missing anything. Now, whether you feel you're missing anything or not has nothing to do with how much you own. You'll know as well as I do from the people you know personally that there are many people who own a lot and feel a lack. And there are many people who own very little and feel no lack. So the feeling of lack has nothing to do with the quantity of ownership. Says God in the Torah, if you live like secure people, if you're willing to trade time for money, if you're willing to trade money for time, if you're willing to trade money for soul, you're willing to buy time for your own soul, even if that costs you money, then the satisfaction. Whatever you've got satisfies you. And you're not pursuing, and you're not running after more. You get off that treadmill because you feel enjoyment and fulfillment with what you've got. You develop satisfaction. That's the bracha. The bracha is not in how much you've got. The bracha is in how little you lack. That's what bracha is. When you get a bracha, it's a bracha that you should lack little. Not that you should have lot. Having a lot doesn't give bracha. Having a lot doesn't, it can give comfort, it can provide comfort, and wealth can be a bracha. But the real bracha is the way you feel about your wealth, whether it's a lot of wealth or a little wealth. The sameach bechelko, that's real ashurus, a person who can enjoy what they've got, who doesn't allow the pursuit of what they don't have to destroy the enjoyment of what they do have. That's bracha. And you'll have that, says Hashem. And if you say, what will we eat in the seventh year? God says, don't worry, everything will be fine. Then he goes on in verse 25. What happens if somebody does have a hard time? Somebody becomes poor. Ki yamuchachicha. U'machar me'achuzosa. And he has to sell his family property. U'vago'alo ha'karovelo v'ga'alis men karachiv. One of the family members should try and buy it back for him. person has a property, it's his business, and he has to sell his business, he's forced to sell his business. Family members should step in and get it back for him. That's what we do. Is that natural? No. If my cousin or brother or nephew has been reckless in business and is losing his business, why should I take my hard-earned money and buy his business back? Because by doing that, I'm investing in my soul. Not investing in his business, not buying his business back. That's chesed and tzedakah. I'm investing in my soul. Once again, I'm exchanging money for soul. That's what I'm doing, and that's what we're meant to do. And if he can't find that, then it waits until the yovel comes back to him. Then it goes further in verse 29. V'ish ki yimkor beit moshav yirchoma. What happens if a person has to sell his home? It's getting worse now. Not only might I have to sell my business, what happens if there's somebody who has to sell his home? Then there's 1 year to be able to buy it back. You've only got 1 year to buy your house back, because the house you move on, you buy another house, or you rent a house, and you move on, you don't necessarily crave the old house. But during the first year, you've got to try and buy it back. And then it goes on to verse 35. And if he gets poor, your brother, your friend gets poor, and he needs money, and he needs you to lend him money, don't take interest. Is that natural? I've got to take money out of the bank where I'm earning interest, or I've got to sell my investments where I'm earning dividends, and I've got to give it as a loan to this person, and I've got to forgo the interest. Is that normal? Well, if I'm only dealing with money, if money is my only currency, then it's not normal, it's not natural. But if I'm trading money for soul, of course I do that. The interest is what I'm investing in my own soul by doing a kindness, by doing a chesed. So I don't take interest. And then we go on. And if he gets even further, if he gets even poorer, and in verse 39, he collapses to such a degree that he's sold to you. You can't get your money back that you've lent him, and he can't pay any of his debts, and he's sold as a slave. He has to sell his time. Again, that's what a slave means. He simply says, there's 5 years left till the Shemitah. I'm willing to sell my labor. I need the money now to pay off my debts, so I can't wait 5 years to earn as I go along. I need the money up now. I need somebody to take care of me for 5 years and to pay me the money up front. That's an eved. And if you buy that eved, if you buy that slave, lo ta'avod ba'avodas oved. Don't treat him like a slave. But I've just bought him. And you know some of the laws that were given, that if you're traveling with your slave on the plane and they come and they say there's an upgrade available, would you like it, Mr. So-and-so? You've got to say, for my slave, please. You're not allowed to take it. You can't go to first class and leave him in economy class. He's got to go first class. You've got to ask yourself, is that normal? It's not normal if you're only dealing with money as your only currency. But if you're trading in soul, then yes, I'm investing money to make my friend who's come down, who's lost his dignity, he's become a slave. Let him enjoy a few hours in first class. What does it cost me? And what does it do for my soul? What does it do for my neshama? So I'm exchanging money for soul. And then it goes even further. What happens if he sells himself to a non-Jew? He might be so desperate that he sells himself to a non-Jew. We've got to try and buy him back. Work out the price. Again, he will come back at the time of the yovel, but we've got to try and buy him back before then. And then at the very end, verse 54, if he isn't, in no way is he able to be redeemed, he goes free at the yovel year, he and any children he had in slavery. Why? And here's the crescendo of the whole symphony. Ki li v'nei Yisrael avodim. You are all slaves, but get it right. You're my slaves, says God. Avodaihem, they are my slaves, asher tzeisi yosom eretz Mitzrayim. They were sold to slavery to Pharaoh. I bought them. I took them over from Pharaoh.
Ani Hashem Elokechem. I am Hashem, your God.
And it ends off with Lo Tasu Lachem Elim V'Pesel. Don't serve idolatry. And Rashi explains, because if you sell to non-Jews and you live among them for a long time and their practice is idolatrous in that area, in that time, you might believe that that's something that you're able to do. You've got to be very careful that that isn't so. So now there's a fascinating Rashi at the end that explains the sequence. So we've seen one thing after another, one more and more desperate case of economic hardship, and how we have to overcome our natural tendencies to preserve our souls in the way we trade, and to make sure that we never trade soul for money, that we're always trading money for soul. Look at the Rashi on verse 1. That's chapter 26, verse 1.
Don't create idols. This is speaking about a Jew who had to sell himself into non-Jewish slavery.
Don't take on the norms of your adopted family, of the people you now work for, of your boss, the person who takes care of you. If their norms are to be improper in their relationships, don't think you should do the same. My master serves idolatry, I will as well. My master doesn't keep Shabbos, I won't keep Shabbos. That's why these psukim are put in. Don't allow that to happen. That's how far this can go to at the end where you're even giving up your Yiddishkeit. And this symphony, says Rashi, all of its movements are structured in the correct order. Bitchilo his hir al hashvi'is. It starts off teaching you about Shemitah year.
Ve'im chomad momen ve'nechshad al hashvi'is. And it's in these words on Rashi that I based the whole shir.
And if he became attached to money and was suspected of compromising Shemitah, it's the attachment to money, putting money before time, that causes one to compromise Shemitah. If that it happens, so for limkor metaltalav. If your value is that money is more important than time, then you will always need money. You'll never have a money. Cash flow becomes very important. You're going to invest in a new business, there's a new opportunity, the stock market is low and you want to buy. So the next thing is you'll sell off other assets.
That's why it talks about when you sell one another, be careful not to overcharge.
And then afterwards, if he doesn't correct himself and realize that he's on a bad track, then he sells his family property. If he doesn't correct himself,
he needs more money, because if money is your most important value, you will never have enough.
That's the principle. It's not about how much you've got, it's about how much you need. And that which is core to us, we need infinite amounts of. If love is core to your value system, you never have enough love. If honesty is core to your value system, you never have enough honesty. If education is core to your value system, you never say, I've got enough education. What's core to your value system, you never have enough of. That's what core means. So if money is core to your value system, you'll never have enough cash. So there'll come a time where you'll sell your property. And you'll say, I'll sell it, I'll get money for it, I'll invest the money, things will turn around, I'll get the money back. But now you've lost your property. Then you've got to sell your house. It's mortgaged already to the bank, and you can't pay, and it's repossessed. We've seen enough of that recently. Why did people do that? Why did people take out loans on their houses that they couldn't pay? Because money is more important than freedom. Rather live in a tent and be free than live in a mansion and be indebted. But not in our society. Who would do such a thing? Because for us, money is more important than freedom. Status is more important than our own freedom. So we would never trade the one for the other. Okay, if you're going to live that way, then you're going to want a house that you can't afford. and you'll think you'll eventually it'll be okay, and the banks will convince you that property will never go down again, and you're on that trajectory, and all of a sudden property does go down, and you can't afford your repayments, so you lose your house. Now you start taking loans, but you can't get a loan at a regular interest rate. Now you're taking loans at ridiculous interest rates because that's all you can get. You don't have property anymore. Now you're in a real mess. It gets worse and worse. Then you sell yourself. You sell your time. You take a job where you've got to commit yourself to long hours to somebody else's business. And eventually you sell yourself even not to a fellow Jew, but to a non-Jew, and you run the risk of starting to attach yourself to the norms of the society in which you're now working, where your livelihood is dependent. And you know what it is, those of you involved in who have been involved directly or indirectly in the entertainment industry, how long does it take for a person working in the entertainment industry to adopt the values of the entertainment industry? How long does it take, Michael?
A minute.
That's what it takes. The Yetzer Hara, the degree to which we accept as normal the norms of the society that feeds us, is horrific how quickly that happens. And that's how the parasha ends. Be careful, because that's the ultimate. You land yourself selling yourself to people of different values, and you start accepting those values as norms, and finally you've lost yourself. And where did it all start? With Shemitah. Because you weren't prepared to exchange money for time. You weren't prepared to buy your time back. You wanted to exchange time for money. Because your core value is money, your core value is not time. If your core value is time, which means freedom, if your core value is the freedom to serve God, the freedom to live your own values, the freedom to invest yourself in yourself, then you do all these unnatural things. Every seventh year, you take a year off as a sabbatical. And if somebody has to sell a property, you make sure that they don't overpay for it. If somebody buys a property from you, you make sure they don't overpay. And if somebody else has to sell their property, you help them reacquire it. And if somebody has to sell their home or their business, you help them reacquire that. You make sure you invest it. Does it cost you money? Of course, all these things cost you money. But they give you freedom. They give you your soul. And that's what this parasha is all about. The parasha is the ability to invest in your own soul. The ability to see that is your primary responsibility. Because as the Zohar says on this week's parasha, a very important phrase, the Sfas Emes talks about a lot and others, that the high ol, this yoke of the service of God, which is the most dignified and honorable yoke we could have, to be employees of God. You know how people at this time of the year, the president's busy announcing the various different people who are going to serve in his cabinet and are serving in his cabinet. People clamor for it. Who would turn it down? To work for the president? To work for the country? What about working for God? What about being one of God's officers? What about being a secretary in God's cabinet? What about being in God's White House? That's what the Jewish people are. We're here to help God govern the world. We're here to help God uplift the world and inspire the world. We're His government. We're here to do that work for Him. But hi, all this job of working for God, lo shara b'man dekafis ba'achar, you can't take that job on if you're working for somebody else. Yeah, you want to become a secretary in the president's cabinet and you've got a business, you have to put your business in a trust. You've got a job, you've got to leave your job. You can't work for two. And so it is with the Ribbono Shel Olam. If we're going to work on God's staff, we have to be sure that that the work that we do is that we're free to do God's work. And freedom means not only freedom from slavery in the normal sense of the world. Yes, Shavuos comes after Yetzias Mitzrayim. We had to free ourselves. And the Sfas Emes talks beautifully. He says, you need to first be enslaved. You need to be enslaved to a system so that you can then switch that system for God's system. Because if you've never learned how to be a slave, you'll never learn how to be a good employee for the Ribbono Shel Olam. So you need to be enslaved first. But you've got to break out of that slavery. And when you've broken out of that slavery, you're in a position where you're prepared to work for Hashem. And so as the Gemara says at the end of Sanhedrin, on the Tzadites Amud Beis, Omar Rabbi Loza, Kol Odom La'om Al Nivra. We're created to work hard. I said last week, if we want to be successful, our success is not the outcome of our efforts. But if we don't put in all the effort possible, miracle doesn't begin. Miracle kicks in where effort ends. But if we hold back our effort, then there is no miracle. And we're created to work. Adam la'omal yulod, that's a verse in Iyov. But eini yodea im la'omal pen nivra im la'omal melach. Are we created for labor or to work with our mouths? Are we created to work with our mouths? What does that mean? To study, to learn Torah, to serve God, to inspire other people, to do chesed, to uplift people, to teach people. Is that our work, or is our work to toil? We see from the Pasuk that we're here to use our mouths. That's how Jews work. We work our mouths, our ability to communicate. And even then, I don't know. Does that mean Torah, or does that mean just having conversations with people and cheering people up? When it says the Sefer Torah should never depart from your mouth, that means that we're here to toil in Torah. And that we're not all able to sit with the Gemara all day and toil with Torah in the literal sense of the word, but it certainly means that in every decision we're making, every dilemma we face, every activity we're involved in, the thought process is a Torah thought process. Am I trading time for money or money for time? Am I selling my soul for tangible assets or am I selling tangible assets to build my soul? That's Adam Lo'omal Uma Yara. That's our business. Our business is to grow our souls. Our business is to trade in soul, but not by selling our soul, but by investing our soul. And every way we can find to invest more in our souls, even where that costs us money, it's not a cost, it's not giving something away, it's an investment. If you buy an amazing investment, if you invest in a property, or you invest in a diamond, or you invest in some stocks in the share market, and you're excited about that, you don't get miserable about how much it costs you. You're busy thinking about how much you're going to gain from it, and you hope it works out that way. That's how it is every time we invest time or money in our neshama. We need to be able to feel the joy of the potential growth, the upside, not the difficulty and the cost of what it is entailed. That's what Jewish business is. Look how far we've drifted. Look how far we've come and how we need to bring ourselves back. And of course, each person, it's hard to bring a nation back. Each of us can just try and bring ourselves back. And just try and at least become mindful. Just catch yourself in the moment. What am I doing? What did I do today? Before you go to sleep at night, just look back at the day and say, did I trade soul for money or money for soul? Did I trade time for money or money for time? What were my values today? That's the test. That's all you have to test for values. Or you don't have to go through your whole day and think of what you did right and what you did wrong. Just that test. What was core to me? What was I willing to trade away? And what was I trying to invest in? And the more we become mindful of that, if you can just train yourself to think about it, you'll find yourself starting to make different choices. Little by little, you'll start to find yourself making different choices. And the result of that is a chain effect. Then you start finding the people around you respond. The people around you notice. The people around you reciprocate and feel the change themselves and feel that pressure themselves. And before you know what's happening, you've affected a whole lot of people just by changing yourself and working on yourself in order to get there. That's this beautiful little parasha of Baha. Just the half of the parasha, because we have reading two parashas this week, but just the parasha of Behar, which is a little standalone symphony, as we said at the outset, that poses the question at the beginning, why open with Shemitah? Why start such an important process with and talk about Har Sinai with Shemitah? Why is this agricultural law so important? And to realize at the end of it, this isn't about agriculture. This is about quality of life. This is about the choice we make as to be whether we want to be human or we want to be machines. And the choice we make is in this parasha of Baha. That's what the parasha is all about. And I hope that in some way it's able to inspire and uplift you as it has me.
Shkem.